You're listening to audio from christian.org.uk, the website of the Christian Institute. You can find hundreds more audio files at christian.org.uk.
Remember the song, "To Dream the Impossible Dream"? Well, trying to communicate the story of the Middle Ages, some 1,000 years of church history in 50 or so minutes, is really the impossible dream. All I can do is give a sort of a crude thumbnail sketch. This is particularly vexing because I have a great fondness for the Middle Ages. Some of my favourite Christians are from this period. So as we go zooming through the Middle Ages at the speed of light, I'll try to highlight some of the great Christian personalities from this long and fascinating era. It may hold particular fascination for you here because in some ways the medieval period is unique in showing us a society and a culture not only saturated from top to bottom in a Christian worldview, but also where the institutional church exercised an unparalleled influence. Medieval Christendom is the model par excellence of a Christian social body on a large canvas. I rank it even higher than the Reformation in that respect, where more often than not the church was reduced into a tool and a vassal of the half-secular state. Let me begin by just setting myself a limit. I'm going to be dealing only with the history of the church in Western Europe here. Was the church in existence anywhere else? Well, yes, in the mighty Byzantine Empire in the east, whose capital was Constantinople. And from the 10th century onwards, the church was spreading through the vast terrains of Russia as well. I have a very warm appreciation for the story of Eastern Christianity, but I think it would be impossible to tell the stories of both East and West in so short a time. So I've decided to look only at the West, and I guess most people here will be more interested anyway in the story of the Western Church because it's our own history. Now, to make the Middle Ages easier to digest, I've divided it up into three rough periods. First of all, in the period from 590 to 870, from Gregory the Great to the Norse invasions. There are debates about when exactly the Middle Ages begin. These are, to a large extent, artificial debates. The title Middle Ages is an invention of modern historians. Nobody at the time woke up one morning and thought the Middle Ages begin today. Somewhat arbitrarily, I'm taking as a marker for the start of the Middle Ages the life of Gregory the Great, after whom Gregorian chant is named. Now, Gregory was pope from 590 to 604. During his 14 years as leader of the Western Church, we begin to see the papacy becoming the great secular as well as spiritual power which would dominate Western Europe for 1,000 years. In the aftermath of the barbarian invasions that destroyed the Roman Empire in the West, Gregory stepped into the power vacuum and began acting as the political representative and protector of Western Catholics in relation to the new Germanic kingdoms which had sprung up in Italy, France, and Spain. Gregory is therefore often seen as the first pope in the medieval and modern sense of the term. Ironically, though, Gregory rejected any claim to be universal bishop. He saw himself as first bishop of the Western Church, but he disowned any authority over the Christians and churches of the East, where the Roman Empire was still alive and well in the shape of the Byzantine Empire. Whoever calls himself universal priest or desires that title, said Gregory, is by his pride the forerunner of Antichrist. Amazingly, despite Gregory's strong words here, his next but one successor, Boniface III, did claim the title of universal bishop. Now, from Gregory the Great onwards for the next 200 years or so, we find one of those periods in church history when the Christian faith makes great social gains. Apart from the Franks, the Germanic tribes who had overrun the Roman Empire in the West were either pagans or Arians. Remember Arianism, the heresy that denied the deity of Christ. Eventually, all these tribal groups were brought to embrace Orthodox Christianity. Gregory the Great himself oversaw the conversion of the Visigoths in Spain and launched a successful missionary campaign among the Jutes of southern England. Northern England and Scotland were Christianized by Celtic monks from Iona. The most famous were Columba, apostle of the Scots, and Aidan of Lindisfarne, sometimes called the father of English Christianity. The conversion of Germany was then brought about by English missionary monks. And the outstanding figure here was Winfrid from the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex. History knows Winfrid better by his Latin name, Boniface. Boniface received strong support from the papacy in his great missionary enterprise in Germany, and in turn he upheld papal authority wherever he preached. He ended his long and fruitful life as a martyr, killed by German pagans in 754. The church gave him the honorary title Apostle of the Germans. Boniface's decades of missionary heroism brought large parts of Germany out of paganism into the brighter world of Christianity. Now, the next significant event in this first period is the founding of the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And the key figure here is Charlemagne. He was king of the Franks, the Germanic tribe that had settled in what we now call France. Charlemagne was undoubtedly the most successful king of the early Middle Ages, and also one of the truly titanic figures of European history. He has been called the Moses of the Middle Ages, because he led the Germanic peoples out of the wilderness of barbarism and gave them a new code of civil and ecclesiastical law. His contemporary biographer Einhard tells us that Charlemagne was a physical giant with enough strength and energy for a dozen ordinary mortals, sober and simple in his private life, a just and generous ruler, an affectionate father, unswervingly loyal to friends, highly popular with his subjects. He had a keen and probing mind, a sincere devotion to the Christian faith and the Catholic Church, and a burning sense of mission to unite the Western nations under the banner of a Christian empire. Now, Charlemagne's military activities extended the Frankish kingdom across much of northern and central Europe, creating the first great Western empire since the fall of Rome. But Charlemagne wasn't just a warrior king. He presided over a remarkable flourishing of culture, which historians call the Carolingian Renaissance. Carolingian comes from Charlemagne's family name. The most influential mind behind the Carolingian Renaissance was an Englishman, Alcuin of York. He was the head of York's cathedral school before entering Charlemagne's service in 782. For the next 22 years, Alcuin was, as it were, the grand schoolmaster of the Frankish Empire. The most cultured man in Western Europe, Alcuin was a Bible commentator, a textual scholar, reviser of the church's liturgy, defender of orthodoxy against heresy, reformer of monasteries, builder of libraries, learned astronomer. Meanwhile, the transformation of Charlemagne's Frankish kingdom into the Holy Roman Empire came about in the following way. It happened on a particular day, Christmas Day, the year 800. And there's some debate about this, but the man behind this whole move or maneuver seems to have been Pope Leo III. On Christmas Day, 800, while Charlemagne was kneeling at the altar in St. Peter's Church, Rome, receiving Holy Communion, surrounded by the Frankish nobility and the Roman clergy, Pope Leo suddenly produced a crown and placed it on Charlemagne's head. Leo's men then shouted out three times, "To Charles Augustus, crowned by God, great and peacemaking emperor of the Romans, long life and victory." And so was born the Holy Roman Empire. Leo's crowning of Charlemagne signified that Charlemagne wasn't simply king of the Franks. He was the heir of the old Roman emperors, the one in whom the Roman Empire had been reborn, the supreme ruler of the Western world. At the same time, Leo's act in crowning Charlemagne announced that the new Roman emperor owed his position to the papacy. Leo was determined to make the emperor dependent for his imperial crown on God's agent, the Pope. Now, Charlemagne himself didn't quite see things that way. He regarded himself as the spiritual as well as the political head of the Holy Roman Empire. And he modelled himself on the good biblical kings of Judah, such as David and Josiah. He interpreted, for example, all public disasters as divine judgments on his empire for its sins and ordered public fasts. For all victories in battle, he ordered public thanksgiving to God. Charlemagne's imperial decrees were more often concerned with religion than they were with politics. They dealt with the recruitment and education of clergy, church discipline, the religious instruction of the laity, and even theological issues. Charlemagne personally presided over church councils and actively participated in them. He assumed authority over the bishops within his empire, nominating men of his choice to vacant bishoprics. In fact, he tended to treat the bishops as a department of the Carolingian civil service. Many bishops were appointed to secular government positions. He took a strong interest in the monasteries, personally appointing many abbots, and he tried to enforce a strict moral code on the lives of the clergy. Charlemagne's religious legislation also affected society at large. For example, he passed strong new laws on the observance of Sunday. Lay people were forbidden to do any work on Sunday, except for burying the dead and transporting food and necessary military supplies. Now, Charlemagne's exalted view of kingship brought him into serious conflict with the papacy. He considered himself invested with power directly from Christ to regulate church affairs within his empire. We can grasp Charlemagne's exalted concept of his own position from a letter that was addressed to him by a Carolingian churchman named Cathwulf. "Always remember, my king, with fear and love for God your king, that you are in God's place. You are set to guard and rule all his members, and you must render an account for them on the day of judgment. The bishop is on a secondary level." That quotation from Cathwulf shows that the thinkers of the Carolingian Renaissance saw the king as vicar of God, standing in God's place. Vicar means one who stands in the place of another. And therefore the king was higher than any bishop, including the supreme bishop, the Pope. Historians often refer to this lofty vision of the rights and duties of monarchs as the ideal of sacred kingship. So the relationship between Charlemagne and the papacy was very uneasy. The creation of the Holy Roman Empire on Christmas Day 800 paved the way for the fierce conflicts between popes and emperors in the later Middle Ages. In this conflict, the papacy stood for the great spiritual principle of the freedom and independence of the church from state control. However, in order to secure that independence, the popes wanted to put the state under the control of the church. Pope Leo III's crowning of Charlemagne could be used to justify the claim that the papacy had given the emperor his crown, and it could also take it away again if the emperor didn't obey the will of the Pope. Now, Charlemagne's son, Louis the Pious, continued to govern the Holy Roman Empire according to his father's ideals, but without his father's abilities. And at the end of his reign, Louis disastrously divided the empire up between his three sons. Further disintegration followed. The popes used this breakup of the Holy Roman Empire to reassert their own supreme authority over church affairs. Yet, paradoxically, they found that the disappearance of their greatest rival, a powerful Holy Roman Emperor,
also meant the loss of their greatest ally. Without an effective emperor to protect them, the popes fell increasingly under the control of the Roman nobility and simply became political pawns in the conflicts of different aristocratic factions. By the early 900s, the papacy had become hopelessly corrupt, incapable of offering any independent leadership to the Western Church. Meanwhile, clouds of war were gathering over the Western Christian world. And the most serious threat came from the pagan Norsemen, or Vikings, whose vast expansion from Scandinavia became serious and all-consuming around about the year 840. A great seafaring people, their ships and warriors brought bloodshed and havoc to Britain, Ireland, France, northern Germany, the Netherlands, Spain, and northern Italy. The 9th and 10th centuries were the true dark ages of political anarchy and constant warfare in Christian Europe. To many Western Christians, it seemed only too credible that the end of the world was at hand, and indeed it was seriously expected to happen in the year 1000. So Charlemagne's empire fell to pieces politically after his death. However, the Carolingian Renaissance, which Charlemagne had nurtured, had given to Western Europe a unity of Christian culture so strong and deep-rooted that it survived the political chaos and formed the basis for the more stable society which emerged in the 11th century. And that brings us then to period number two, roughly 870 to 1216, from the Cluniac Revival to Pope Innocent III. Now, the war and devastation which the Norsemen brought to Western Europe in the 9th and 10th centuries almost destroyed Christian civilization. The Norse warriors showed no respect for religion. They burned down churches and monasteries, slaughtered priests and monks, and raped nuns with alarming regularity. To their victims, it seemed quite impossible that these savage pagan killers could ever embrace the Christian faith. But the impossible happened. And it began in England. The Norsemen of Denmark conquered and colonised much of the northeastern half of the country and then pushed south to try and take over the rest of England. Now, at that time, England wasn't a united country. It was divided up into a number of separate Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. And these fell one by one to the Danish invaders. However, the English people of the southern kingdom of Wessex fought back under their outstanding young Christian king, Alfred the Great. Alfred finally crushed the Danish army decisively in 878 at the Battle of Edington in Wiltshire, and forced the Danes to accept a peaceful division of the land. One of Alfred's terms of peace was that the Danish king, Guthrum, and his court should be baptised. Alfred hoped this would discourage the Danes from persecuting the Christian English in the Danish half of the island. And so the Danes in England submitted to the Christian faith. From his own lifetime to the present day, Alfred has been intensely admired by many for the noble quality of his mind and spirit. In fact, he's the only English king who has ever received the title The Great. His mighty contribution to the development of English Christian culture also earned him the title The Charlemagne of England. In fact, far more than Charlemagne, Alfred came to symbolise the ideal of Christian kingship among the English-speaking peoples. Alfred saw it as his God-given duty to create a flourishing Christian civilisation in his kingdom of Wessex. So, acting as a sacred king, he devoted his royal power to the supreme mission of organising church affairs, raising moral and academic standards among the clergy, and promoting the religious knowledge of the English people. He gave away half his personal income to the building and maintenance of churches and schools. He also personally translated into English a number of the great Latin works of theology, spirituality, and philosophy, as well as the first 50 Psalms. In his private life, Alfred was a devout, humble, and prayerful Christian. He knew the liturgy and many of the Psalms by heart, and swore an oath to divide his time equally between the political affairs of his kingdom and the spiritual affairs of his faith. He suffered from a mysterious lifelong illness, which often left him in agony for lengthy periods, and this softened his naturally warlike spirit into something more gentle. Soon after Alfred's death, he was described thus by an Anglo-Saxon historian: "Alfred, unshakable pillar of the people of Wessex, a man full of justice, vigorous in war, wise in speech, and above all, learned in holy literature, for he translated countless numbers of books from Latin into English with such variety and skill that not only scholars, but anyone who wished could understand them. O Redeemer Christ, save his soul." Now, Alfred, in many ways, was the founder of the English nation. The Anglo-Saxon kingdoms of England had never come together politically prior to the Norse invasions. Alfred united half the island around his own kingdom of Wessex, and that paved the way for the complete unification of England under his grandson Athelstan. Alfred also founded the English navy, created a new and stronger English army, built fortified towns and cities which could withstand Viking attacks, and initiated the official recording of English history via the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. So Alfred's Wessex became the spiritual heart of that new Christian England, which was eventually to have such a profound influence on the world from the days of John Wycliffe onwards. After the conversion of the Danes in England, the conversion of the Norse kingdoms of Normandy, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, and Finland all followed. Now, after the collapse of Charlemagne's Holy Roman Empire and the devastation wrought by the Norse invasions, the revival and reconstruction of a strong Christian society in Western Europe sprang from a partnership between the monasteries, which had preserved the culture of the Carolingian Renaissance, and the Western monarchies, monastery and monarchy. The most important of these monarchies was in Germany. By 900, Charlemagne's empire in Germany had almost broken up. However, the invading Magyar peoples from Asia forced a fresh unity on the Germans. In order to protect themselves, they banded together under a new king, Henry I, who inflicted on the Magyars their first great military defeat. Henry's son, Otto the Great, then refurbished the whole Carolingian ideal of the Holy Roman Empire, fighting successful wars against Magyars and Norsemen and making Germany into a great national power. In the alliance between monastery and monarchy, which rebuilt Western Europe, there was one monastery in particular that stood out and led the movement for establishing Christian values in society. And this was the monastery of Cluny in southeastern France. It was founded in the year 909 by William the Pious, Duke of Aquitaine. And Cluny was led by a series of great reforming abbots. The role of Cluny in helping to shape a new Christian West has been described as the Cluniac Revival. Abbot Odo was the real inspiration behind this Cluniac Revival. Odo deliberately established daughter monasteries from Cluny. And in the year 931, Pope John XI gave Cluny the right to control these other satellite monasteries. Now that meant that these monasteries didn't have abbots of their own. They only had priors. Normally a prior was second in command to an abbot. The priors of the Cluniac monasteries were appointed by Odo and took a vow of obedience to the abbot of Cluny. So a great network of Cluniac monasteries spread across France and Germany, all under the central direction of Cluny. By the year 1100, there were something like 1,000 Cluniac monasteries. From its very foundation, Cluny enjoyed freedom from all secular or political control. In 999, it also received, from Pope Gregory V, freedom from all episcopal authority. So Cluny was to be subject only and exclusively to the Pope. But until the great reform of the papacy in the mid-11th century, the papacy itself was corrupt and powerless. For 150 years, the abbots of Cluny, not the popes of Rome, were the central figures in the Christian life of Western Europe. Now, although Cluny had this freedom from political control, there grew up an intimate relationship between the Cluniac monks and the secular rulers, the dukes, princes, kings and emperor. Indeed, the Cluniac revival itself helped to spread Christian ideals to the ruling classes, because part of the Cluniac policy was to take the sons of royalty and aristocracy into Cluniac monasteries to give them a good, solid Christian education, and then send them out again so that they could govern society according to Christian ideals. An especially powerful partnership grew up between Cluny and the kings of Western Christendom. The abbots of Cluny believed that the best hope of making Europe into a truly Christian society lay in strong Christian monarchies being established, which could rule society according to Christian values. Now, as I mentioned, while Otto the Great and his successors were rebuilding the Holy Roman Empire, the papacy was in a state of almost hopeless moral and spiritual degradation. It had become a mere political pawn in the hands of the Roman aristocracy, who fought over who should own the papacy. Things reached a crisis point in the year 1054. In that year, there was a violent uprising in Rome against Pope Benedict IX, a scandalously immoral man. Another pope, Sylvester III, briefly ascended the papal throne in 1045. But Benedict's political allies then managed to put Benedict back in power. Benedict, however, tired of being pope, it seems, sold the papacy to a third candidate, Gregory VI, but then changed his mind and reclaimed the papacy. So when the Holy Roman Emperor Henry III arrived in Rome in 1046 so that the Pope could officially crown him emperor, he found three rival popes. Henry III was undoubtedly the most striking product of the Cluniac revival. Everything the Cluniac abbots believed in found its fulfilment in Henry. He was the perfect Cluniac king, holy and pure in his personal life, just and wise as a ruler, a dedicated Christian reformer of church and society. Faced with this impossible situation in Rome of three rival popes, Henry called a special synod at Sutri, that's a small town just north of Rome, and the synod deposed all three popes. Henry himself then placed a good German bishop on the papal throne, Pope Clement II. This act of Henry is known as the cleansing of the papacy. Acting as a sacred king, the Holy Roman Emperor lifted the papacy out of its pit of corruption and placed it in the hands of a party of committed reformers. The most important of these reformers were Hildebrand, Humbert of Meilmoutier, and Peter Damiani. Historians have named the reform movement after the first and greatest of those figures, Hildebrand, hence the Hildebrandine reform movement. Hildebrand himself became pope in 1073, and he took the name Gregory VII. Now, the Hildebrandine reform movement really created the papacy as we know it today. The Hildebrandine reformers wanted to make the papal court in Rome into a truly Christian institution which would practice the highest moral standards and be a spiritual example to the rest of the church. In order to achieve this, They wanted to free the papacy from political control by the Roman aristocracy. The more radical of the reformers, like Humbert and Hildebrand, wanted to make the papacy independent even of the Holy Roman Emperor. The church must be independent of the state, they argued, so that it can pursue its own spiritual purposes unhindered. But alongside that, they also elevated the claims of the papacy to more soaring heights than ever before. For the Hildebrandine reformers, the Pope was the infallible successor of the Apostle Peter, standing in Peter's place, Peter's vicar, sanctified by Peter's merits, almost a reincarnation of Peter. When Hildebrand became Pope, he said, "I am Peter's vicar, he now lives in my body." By virtue of that, they claimed to exercise absolute authority over all other bishops, churches, and indeed secular governments throughout the Holy Roman Empire. This sparked off fierce conflict within the empire between popes and emperors. Hildebrand himself died in exile from Rome, driven out by Emperor Henry IV. But Hildebrand's ideals eventually triumphed, and the papacy was set on a path of power and glory, which reached its high noon in Pope Innocent III. Look at him in a moment. The next great event, or series of events in our second period, were the Crusades. Now, the Crusades were basically military expeditions masterminded by the new reformed Hildebrandine papacy to liberate the Holy Land from the rule of the Muslim Turks. There were four chief crusades. The first and the most successful began in 1096. The fourth ended in 1204. It was in the Crusades that the ideals of chivalry and the concept of the knight as a Christian figure blossomed into their full splendour. And so a strange new figure emerged on the scene, the monastic knight, who combined the two vocations of knight and monk, bringing together the spiritual disciplines of the monastery with the military code of chivalry. The three great monastic knightly orders were the Knights of St. John, the Knights of the Temple, and the Teutonic Knights. The Crusades continue to exercise a romantic appeal to the Western imagination even today. And we can see that on television and in Hollywood films. However, it must be said, they inflicted almost irreparable damage on Christian-Muslim relationships. When the crusading knights poured into the Middle East, they made no attempt to evangelize the native Muslim population. Muslims were simply seen as enemies of Christ to be killed without mercy. Islam has a long memory, and it still thinks of the Crusades when it looks at the so-called Christian West of today. Now, if Hildebrand created the papacy as we know it, it was another pope, Innocent III, who made Hildebrand's concept of the papacy into an effective reality. Innocent was pope from 1198 to 1216, and he represents the papacy at the height of its political power. Innocent humbled the three greatest monarchs of Western Europe into the very dust beneath his feet, the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of France, and King John of England. Innocent was also the first pope who officially claimed the title Vicar of Christ. Up until now, popes had called themselves the vicars of St. Peter. Innocent upped the stakes by denying that he was the vicar of Peter and asserting that he was the vicar of Christ. A number of important new religious movements also came on the scene in this period, the period when Innocent was around. And the most important of these within the Catholic Church were the Franciscans and the Dominicans. Now, they represented an entirely new kind of monasticism, one that was outward-looking, devoted to working in the world rather than retreating from it. To mark this novelty, Franciscans and Dominicans were given a new distinctive title, friars, from the Latin word for brothers. The Franciscans, of course, were founded by the most famous and popular saint of the Middle Ages, Francis of Assisi, a magnetic and winsome figure who loved nature and was devoted to poverty. The Dominicans were founded by Dominic, a Spanish evangelist, who at first worked among the heretical Cathars of France, trying to win them back to the church. Most of the great theologians of the later Middle Ages were to be friars. Ultimately, the Protestant Reformation itself sprang from this source. Martin Luther was an Augustinian friar. Now, this second period has one last feature I think we should look at, namely scholastic theology. The word scholastic simply comes from the word school, scholastic theology, school theology, and at that time, school meant university. So scholastic theology means the theology that was developed and taught in the universities. Now, the university itself, as an institution of learning, sprang up in Western Europe in this same period, inspired to a great extent by Islamic example. The Islamic world was intellectually far in advance of Western Christendom at this time. The scholastic theologians are among the greatest thinkers in the history of Christianity. Anselm of Canterbury, Peter Abelard, Peter Lombard, Albertus Magnus, Thomas Aquinas, Duns Scotus, William of Ockham. Perhaps the most attractive of them to us would be the first, Anselm, often called the father of scholastic theology. Anselm, an Italian by birth, was Archbishop of Canterbury from 1093 to 1109. He was one of the greatest saints of the Western medieval church, a man of spotless life, unflinching devotion to truth and righteousness, and a profound reverence and love for Christ. People today still turn to Anselm's prayers and meditations for spiritual nourishment. They display an awesome sense of intimacy with a great and holy God. In terms, however, of intellectual achievement, the greatest of the scholastic theologians was another Italian, Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas's masterpiece of systematic theology, the Summa Theologiae, inspired generation after generation of future theologians right up to the present day. Even the great Protestant theologians of the 16th and 17th century confessed their debt to Aquinas, despite their passionate disagreement with some of his views. For example, it was Aquinas who worked out in fullest detail the doctrine of transubstantiation, that is, the belief that the inner substance or essence of the bread and wine in the Lord's Supper ceased to be bread and wine and are miraculously converted into the essence of Christ's body and blood. Interestingly, it was around that same time, and partly because of that belief, that the Western Catholic Church began to withhold the cup from the laity in the supper out of a fear of spilling the transubstantiated wine. This was the end product of a movement which, throughout the Middle Ages, had seen the laity participate less and less in a service of worship, so that by Aquinas's time in the 13th century, the laity virtually ended up just listening to and watching the priest do everything. Catholics now took part in Holy Communion only once a year at Easter. Now, before leaving our second period, I think we have to pay tribute to another of its great figures, Bernard of Clairvaux, and his dates are 1090 to 1153. When the Protestant reformers broke with the papacy in the 16th century, they made severe criticisms of many medieval saints and theologians, but they could never bring themselves to speak harshly of Bernard. Martin Luther, in his commentary on Galatians, extolled Bernard as a shining example of a man who lived by genuine, heartfelt faith in Christ. Bernard, a man so godly, so holy, so pure, that we should commend and prefer him before all the teachers of the church. That's Luther. Bernard was one of the greatest preachers of the Middle Ages, probably one of the great preachers of all time. His nickname, they were fond of giving nicknames to their great figures in the medieval period, and Bernard's nickname was the honey-flowing teacher, because his sermons seemed to drip with the love of Christ. Martin Luther again said this of Bernard's sermons. In his sermons, Bernard is superior to all the teachers, even to Augustine himself, because he preaches Christ so excellently. Bernard's dominating position in the life of the Western Church in the 1100s was quite remarkable. He was never anything more than the abbot of Clairvaux in France, and yet kings, emperors, popes came and sat at his feet. All attempts to elevate him to higher office in the church, he resisted fiercely and successfully. It's been said of Bernard, in his solitude he governed all the churches of the West. If we know him today, it's probably as a hymn writer. Among the hymns attributed to Bernard are Jesus, Thou Joy of Loving Hearts, Jesus, the Very Thought of Thee, O Jesus, King Most Wonderful, and O Sacred Head, Sore Wounded. And that brings us on then to our third and final period, roughly 1216 to 1500-ish, from the Avignonese captivity of the papacy to the Hussites. If the papacy reached its zenith of power under Innocent III, there followed a period of decline and ultimately catastrophe. In part, this was due to the growth of nationalism. The kings of the European nations were growing less and less patient with the papacy's pretensions to world dominion. Violent conflict raged between the popes and the Holy Roman emperors of Germany, and even more with the kings of France. The end result was that the papacy became a complete captive to the French monarchy and its policies. Beginning in 1309, a series of French popes abandoned Rome altogether and took up residence in the southern French city of Avignon. And there they remained for nearly 70 years, 1309 to 1377, willing slaves of the French monarchy. Historians call this the Avignonese captivity of the papacy. It had an utterly devastating effect on the prestige and influence of the popes. According to Catholic theory, the Apostle Peter had been the Bishop of Rome and therefore the first pope. That's why the Church and Bishop of Rome were paramount. With the popes now in Avignon, torn loose from their ancient historic seat in Rome, it seemed to many that the papacy had lost its true identity and become nothing more than a political pawn in the hands of the French kings. The Avignonese captivity led to several quite remarkable attacks on the papacy by Christian thinkers. The most radical critique of papal claims was made by the Italian thinker Marsilius of Padua, 1280 to 1343. Marsilius argued that authority lay with the people, the whole body of citizens in the state, and the whole body of believers in the church. Political and spiritual leaders, therefore, were appointed by the people and accountable to the people. The supreme legislative power in the church, he said, was not the papacy, but a general council representing the entire body of the faithful. And scripture alone was the source of Christian teaching. Furthermore, Marsilius insisted, the pope has no right to depose kings and emperors. In all secular matters, the clergy are subject to the state, like all other people. The only power priests have is the power to teach, warn, persuade, and rebuke. Now, since Marsilius accepted the medieval idea that church and state are the spiritual and political aspects of one single Christian society, he also taught that a Christian state has the right to call church councils, appoint clergy, and control church property. In the 16th century, the Protestant reformers were to take up many of Marsilius's ideas, And for that reason, Roman Catholic historians have called Marsilius a forerunner of Martin Luther and John Calvin. Well, the Avignonese captivity finally ended in 1377, but at the even more terrible cost of schism. Two rival popes were elected by the cardinals. One pope stayed in Avignon, the other took up residence in Rome. Catholic Europe was split down the middle as the two popes hurled anathemas at each other. This event is known as the Great Schism, and it lasted for some 40 years. The minds of many loyal churchmen eventually began to feel that the answer to the scandal of the Great Schism must be found in a general council of the whole church and in making the papacy subject to the authority of the council. Those who thought like this were called conciliarists. It's from the Latin word concilium, council. The conciliarists taught that the Catholic Church was superior to the Roman Church, and that infallibility didn't belong to the papacy, but to the church as a whole, represented by a general council. Church authority, they argued, rested ultimately in the entire body of believers to whom even the Pope was accountable. We can see some of Marsilius's ideas, of course, here. The Catholic Church, they said, bestowed authority on the papacy to be exercised for the church's good. If a pope abused this authority, then a general council could depose him. The first attempt by the conciliarists to end the Great Schism by means of a general council took place in 1409 at the Council of Pisa. But it was a total failure, and they ended up with three rival popes. In 1414-18, the Council of Constance made another attempt to end the schism. This time it was successful. The three rival popes were all removed from office by the council, and then a new unchallenged pope was elected, Martin V. Finally, the council decreed that a new council should meet in 5 years' time, and then another in 7 years, and thereafter once every 10 years. The Council of Constance was revolutionary. It had ended the Great Schism, but only by subjecting the papacy to the authority of a council. It seemed the conciliarists had demolished the absolute papal monarchy of Hildebrand and Innocent III, replacing it with a more limited, constitutional, democratic form of church government. However, the new pope, Martin V, after ascending the papal throne, basically abandoned whatever conciliarist convictions he may have had, and there was much friction between him and the next two councils. Martin's successor, Pope Eugenius IV, managed to turn the tables on the conciliarists, who bungled their case badly, so that by 1449, the papacy was back in control. And that marked the effective end of the conciliar movement. Eugenius had re-established the papacy as the true leader of Western Catholicism. The conciliar theory did live on in the church, but the almost incredible incompetence of the conciliarists in the aftermath of the Council of Constance had ruined any hope of making the Catholic Church into a more democratic body. Now, this period of the Avignonese captivity and the Great Schism saw another and potentially much more deadly challenge to the papacy arise, first in England and then even more in Bohemia. The English challenge to a divided and discredited papacy came through the life and writings of John Wycliffe. Wycliffe was a native of Yorkshire and a theologian at Oxford University. His contemporaries tell us that he was a thin man who never enjoyed good health. He had an open, honest, forthright character, which endeared him to his fellow countrymen, and he was gifted with a fearlessly independent and questing mind, one of the finest of its age. When the Great Schism broke out in 1378, and Catholic Europe was split between the two rival popes, Wycliffe's theology began to become much more overtly radical. He published a book called The Truth of Holy Scripture, in which he argued that the Bible was the only authoritative source of Christian doctrine, by which believers must test all the teachings of the church, including the papacy and general councils. All Christians should read the Bible, he said, so it must be translated from the Latin of the Vulgate into the native languages of the various nations. Now, Wycliffe's views here were quite revolutionary. In the Middle Ages in Western Europe, people had come to regard the Bible as the clergy's book. Priests and theologians alone could interpret it aright and then teach lay people what it meant. The Catholic Church looked with great suspicion on the idea that a lay person should study the Bible for himself. Later on, in 1378, Wycliffe wrote another important book entitled On the Church. This revealed him as a devoted follower of the early church father Augustine. Wycliffe defined the church not in terms of an outward organisation controlled by papacy and priesthood, but as the whole body of the elect, those predestined to salvation by the grace of God. The church was thus a spiritual and invisible body rooted in God's eternal election, infallibly known to God alone, and its head not the Pope, but Christ himself. The following year, 1379, Wycliffe wrote The Power of the Pope. Here he argued that the papacy was of human, not divine, origin, and denied that the Pope had any authority over any secular government. If a particular Pope imitated the Apostle Peter by living a holy life, he could then claim to exercise Peter's authority, but a Pope who did not follow Christ was Antichrist. Later on, Wycliffe declared that all popes, not just the bad ones, were Antichrist. Then in 1380 came Wycliffe's boldest stroke. He attacked the Catholic doctrine of Holy Communion in his treatise on the Eucharist. Here, Wycliffe rejected the doctrine of transubstantiation and went back to the earlier views of Augustine. The bread and wine of Holy Communion, Wycliffe argued, remained bread and wine in their own nature. Their substance was not miraculously changed. Christ's body and blood were truly eaten and drunk, but in a spiritual manner by the soul through faith. Now, by Catholic standards, Wycliffe's denial of transubstantiation had transformed him into a dangerous heretic. He lost all the official support that he had enjoyed up until then and was expelled from Oxford University. He retired to Lutterworth in the English Midlands, where he was the parish priest. And he spent the last 3 years of his life there, overseeing a team of his disciples who translated the Latin Vulgate Bible into English, a task not finished until after Wycliffe's death. The first of these translations, so this will be the first ever complete English Bible, appeared in 1384. It was a very stiff and literal translation of the Vulgate. Wycliffe's secretary, John Purvey, produced a second version in 1396. Purvey's translation was much more popular than the first 1384 version. It had a very wide circulation in the period between its appearance and the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. Wycliffe also sent out teams of preachers to proclaim the gospel and provided sermons for them. Wycliffe died of a stroke in 1384 and was buried in the Lutterworth Church graveyard. Somewhat belatedly, 34 years later, the church authorities dug up his body, burnt it posthumously for heresy, and threw its ashes into the River Swift. Protestants have hailed Wycliffe as the morning star of the Reformation. His followers were called Wycliffeites or Lollards. This is a rather obscure term. Originally, it seems to have been a term of abuse, and it probably means mumblers, although I'm not quite sure why a Wycliffeite would be called a mumbler. But anyway, Lollards was the name that eventually stuck. The Lollards became a secret underground sect. They were found mainly in London and the surrounding areas in southern England, although they did penetrate throughout the rest of the country, and there was a flourishing Lollard movement in Scotland as well. Despite the persecution, the Lollards survived until the Protestant Reformation, and in many ways they helped to prepare the way for it in England by circulating Lollard tracts and the English Bible. When the Reformation did come to England, the Lollards were its earliest supporters, and they soon merged into the mainstream of English Protestantism. Now, Wycliffe's ideas had a far greater success in the Holy Roman Empire than they ever did in England. A number of Bohemian students studied theology at Oxford University at the time when Wycliffe was active, and they took his views and his writings back to Bohemia, especially to the University of Prague, Bohemia's capital city. There was already a religious reform movement underway in Bohemia, aimed at purifying the church from worldliness and returning to the Bible. In that atmosphere, Wycliffe's ideas spread rapidly. There was no effective opposition from a discredited papacy. This was the period of the Great Schism. The most outstanding of the Bohemian reformers was John Huss, preacher at the Bethlehem Chapel in Prague from 1402, and then rector of Prague University from 1409. Huss studied and greatly admired Wycliffe's writings. Some of Huss's own works reproduce Wycliffe almost word for word. Plagiarism, I suppose, but of a noble kind. Now, when the great reforming Council of Constance met in 1414, the religious turmoil in Bohemia was one of the issues it had to settle. The council summoned Huss to appear before it. Huss knew he was in danger of being condemned and burnt at the stake as a heretic. His theology was unacceptable, even to the conciliarist reformers who controlled the council. However, Huss was given a promise of safe conduct by the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, brother of the Bohemian king Wenceslas. Huss therefore went to Constance. The council, however, ignored the safe conduct and threw Huss in prison almost immediately on his arrival. He was kept captive for 6 months in very unhygienic conditions, which basically destroyed his health. He became subject to headaches, fever, bleeding and vomiting. While Huss was languishing in prison, his disciples in Prague started giving the wine as well as the bread to the laity in Holy Communion, an act of open defiance of Catholic practice, and Huss was in full agreement with what his followers did. Finally, in June 1415, the church authorities brought the now very sick Bohemian reformer before the council, which refused to allow him to defend himself, bullied him mercilessly for 3 days in an attempt to get him to renounce his heresies, and finally condemned him and deposed him from the priesthood. We're told that in a rather humiliating ceremony, 6 bishops stripped off Huss's priestly vestments, put on his head a cap covered in pictures of red demons, and solemnly committed Huss's soul to the devil. "And I," Huss replied, "commit myself to my most gracious Lord Jesus." The council then handed Huss over to the Emperor Sigismund, the man who'd promised him safe conduct. Sigismund's soldiers burnt Huss at the stake on July the 6th, 1415. Huss died with courage, refusing a last-minute offer of pardon if he would abandon his beliefs. "I shall die with joy today in the faith of the gospel which I have preached." Now, Huss's martyrdom created an uproar in Bohemia. He became overnight a popular national hero. The Bohemians were then further enraged when, at Emperor Sigismund's insistence, the council also burnt at the stake Huss's foremost disciple, the noble and learned layman Jerome of Prague, in 1416. Bohemia was now smouldering with rage, ready to blaze up against the slightest further provocation. The spark which ignited the blaze came in 1419 when King Wenceslas died. Wenceslas' brother, the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund, should by rights have succeeded to the Bohemian throne. But Sigismund was the most hated man in Bohemia, stained with the holy blood of Huss and Jerome. Passions boiled over and civil war erupted between the nation and its monarch. Pope Martin V came to Sigismund's aid and declared a crusade against the heretical Bohemians. But, to the astonishment and fury of their foes, the Bohemians defeated the crusading armies again and again and again. By 1433, after 14 years of fierce warfare, it had become all too clear that the Catholics could not defeat the Hussites on the field of battle. So for the first time in its history, the Catholic Church was forced to sit down and negotiate with a dissenting group. The Council of Basel managed to reach a compromise agreement with the Hussites called the Four Articles of Prague. Now, there were further struggles after that, but basically the end result of the Hussite Wars was that most Bohemians remained within the Catholic Church, but as a distinct body, with their own Hussite traditions and Hussite practices. A significant minority of the Hussites broke away entirely from the official church and remained outside the national Bohemian church. From about 1458 onwards, they formed themselves into a separate body called the United Bohemian Brotherhood. By 1500, the Brotherhood had 300 or 400 congregations in Bohemia and Moravia, with their own confession of faith and their own Hussite hymns. Relations were always uneasy between Hussite Bohemia and the papacy. And with the advent of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, the vast majority of Bohemians welcomed it, and the Hussite movement flowed into the mightier ocean of Protestantism. And so there's my thumbnail sketch then of the Middle Ages in Western Europe. I hope it's been interesting. I hope it's whetted your appetite. And if I've managed to persuade anyone that the Middle Ages weren't just a boring waste of time between the early church and the Reformation, I'll go away feeling reasonably satisfied.